ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to the Attention Please podcast, now on video. If you like this podcast, then kindly share, like, and subscribe. You know what to do. So today I thought I would talk about the three farm bills, or the three farm bills that once were, because those farm bills have now been rescinded. Now, those of you who follow my podcast know that I have done a detailed deconstruction of the farm bills before, and so I don't really want to repeat what I have already said. But if there's one thing that this proves, the so-called farmers' agitation proves, is just how powerful the farmers' lobby has been in India. And this is fairly a global phenomenon, that farmers are powerful everywhere, but more so in India, which is why we've never really had significant reforms in the farming sector. Even though economists, bureaucrats, and wise know-it-alls love to say this in different fora, that this country needs farmer reforms and reforms in the farming sector, this just goes to show that it's just not possible. And the reason why it doesn't happen is not because of people don't know what to do, but purely because of the lack of solid political will to see it through. Now, over the last 1 year or so, the narrative that has been that you've heard, I'm guessing, if you are against the farmer bills, and even those who are pro, like I have been, the narrative that I saw essentially was that there was, on one hand, there is Ambani and Adani and all the big interests, big financial interests, who are colluding with the fascist Hindu nationalist government. And these people are on one side. And on the other side, there are these poor farmers who are just trying to eke out a living, farmers that are economically pressed to the wall. And what has happening is that Ambani, Adani, and all these big industrial houses are essentially exerting their influence to force the government to make laws that compromise the interests of these small, medium farmers. This is roughly the narrative. I have tried to read up on like what exactly is the problem with the whole farmer bills, and I've never really found any solid reasoning as to why this is so disastrous. Except, of course, that this will help big farming companies to come into India. This is basically the same kind of fear-mongering that one saw in the 60s and the 70s when the government forced computerization onto our institutes. I remember my grandmother telling me the first day that we bought a PC, which was a PC for Pentium back in the 90s, that I can't believe that a computer is coming to our house. I remember sitting on a dharna in ISI. She used to work in the Indian Statistical Institute, because the union has said that and told her that, you know, these computers will essentially make the work of everybody redundant. And this might be fine in Western societies, but in Eastern societies where there are so many people who are unemployed, this is the harbinger of Thanos' snap. Of course, none of this happened. Actually, this helped India, but that's the kind of fear-mongering that usually happens when you have vested interests who do not want things to change. Now, in this case, I'm coming back to the point, and if you believed this narrative of big industry allied with a government which is fascist in nature, arrayed against the democratic agitation of the farmers, medium, small farmers, a rainbow coalition of farmers. Here's the thing, here's something to think about. Well, do you think that given the way politics works, do you think that the Ambanis and Adanis backed by a fascist government would back down? If that indeed was the case, do you think that poor farmers would have won? No, they wouldn't have, right? The very fact that they won, let's presume that there were a lot of vested interests that were pushing the farm bill. Let's presume for a second. The very fact that the quote-unquote farmers won gives you some idea as to how powerful these farmers were. And again, in my previous podcast, I had said that this represents rich farmers. Just like there is big business and there's small business, just like there is Ambani, Adani, Tata, Birla, and then there is the grocer on the corner store, just like that, there are farmers of different financial abilities. And this bill essentially was agnostic to small farmers. Most small farmers just do not have the money. They are so deep in debt that they don't have the money mostly to take their produce to these kinds of farmers' markets, the intermediaries. So the beneficiaries of MSP minimum support price are usually these very large farmers. And that's why the agitation was localized to a very few prosperous farming states. It did not spread throughout India. That should be proof. But the main point is that this whole narrative of this David versus Goliath narrative, it usually never happens in politics and democracy that the David wins, which means that the other side wasn't David. It was a very, very well-funded, and that's fine. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong about, you know, every interest group in India in a democratic society has the right to protest, has the right to protect its interests. And just like industry has the right to do it, just like workers have the right to do it, so do farmers. So there is nothing illegitimate, I would say, in their protest. But it still was, and it still is, not a moral issue as so much as a very powerful pressure group trying to protect their privilege, which is the way it was never. I've never seen it in mainstream media being messaged like this. And what happened should tell you that that was exactly what it was. It was at least a battle of equals. If you had big industry on one hand, you had big farming on the other, and ultimately the big farming won. And the reason why they won is because, firstly, they have a lot of money. They have a lot of political power, even within the BJP. And the kind of support that they got internationally on social media to exert pressure on the government, it just shows you that it wasn't that there was no money involved on the other side. There was a significant amount of money involved on the other side, on the side of the farmers, which would, in again, it's, I understand for the nature of the narrative that we call them farmers, but they were essentially a coalition of farmers and middlemen who were the true beneficiaries of the current system. But whatever it is water under the bridge. And for me, at least, the significance of this movement is more of what it says about the current Narendra Modi government. And for me, I believe that this has possibly been the biggest failure of the Narendra Modi government so far. And bear with me when I say this. People will say, well, what about demonetization? And I agree that in terms of policy, demonetization was a flawed policy. Let's just not say it was just badly implemented, that it was, but ultimately it was flawed policy. However, it did not hurt Narendra Modi government and the BJP government much. As a matter of fact, I felt that it actually helped it. This is paradoxical, that sometimes bad policy actually helps the party in power. In this case, what happened was that the way the narrative, again, politics is all about narrative, as I've told you various times. You know, people don't go to vote based on data, based on graphs, based on projections by the World Bank. They go and vote based on emotion. It's true in the US, it's true in India, it's true in any democratic society. And how do we form emotion? We form emotion if we connect with a certain story. Now, that story may be true, it may be false, and it usually is something in between. So the story of demonetization was that here was a very powerful, here was this government that you elected with an overwhelming mandate. And what the government did was they tried to stamp out black money. So that was the narrative. Whether it was effective or not is another question. How much black money came back? What kind of hardship it caused the people for that benefit, whether it was worth it? That's to the side. But even with this hardship, what the common people saw that they were standing in line, but the rich guy was also standing in line. Not the very rich guys, they never saw them, of course, but at least the rich guy were also standing in line, and everybody was pissed off. So they felt that they were kind of equalized, and that they felt that they were not discriminated. And for the rich guy, this was a bigger worry than poor people who are used to, you know, standing in lines for virtually everything. So this looked, at least from a story perspective, as here is Narendra Modi, here is a very strong-willed 56-inch chest guy coming in and then, you know, taking his authority. And by the way, in a democracy, authority actually works. People mostly, and this is again the reason why UPA 2 ultimately lost the plot, because at least the narrative was that Manmohan Singh was not in charge, that there was no strong authority that was ruling the country, that the country was essentially being ruled by nameless, either by Sonia Gandhi or by nameless bureaucrats or by coalition partners, but definitely not the person in, ostensibly in power, was not the person in power. This was what I believed hurt the UPA to the most. And this was where Narendra Modi showed the sharpest contrast. And I think this is the emotional reason why we still have people saying, I'll vote for Kejriwal in Delhi, but I'll vote for Modi at the center. Because Modi is seen as an honest, very decisive person who has essentially done things which, whether you agree with them or not, he has done them. He has made fundamental changes, whether it's be Article 370, whether it be demonetization, he's gone in, GST, he's gone in with these really big ticket items, for, against, whatever you are, but he's gone through with them and he's followed them through. And ultimately, with in a democracy, I think that's what people are looking for. As in a contrast, I am in US politics, when Biden was trying to pass his infrastructure bill and it was being held up by two members of his own political party, the narrative that was coming from the liberal media, the Democrats, was that, hey, we have all the things lined up, we have power everywhere, why are we not being able to push this legislation? Why aren't we being more assertive? Why aren't we being more, quote-unquote, undemocratic? That was what the narrative was. Now, in this case, Narendra Modi has done that throughout his rule. Despite opposition, despite the opposition to GST, despite the opposition to demonetization, he's pushed it through. And people have appreciated that. They've appreciated the fact that he can follow through with what he says he's going to do. And there is an expectation in any democratic society for the ruler to be decisive. This is the first time that he has basically rolled back what he, you know, put in a lot of investment into. I mean, him, his sympathetic media, they put a lot of investment into this story. And for him to then say that, okay, I'm withdrawing this farm bills. And there was, again, the narrative, the story has been lost. I think the BJP has kind of lost the plot. It's no coincidence that this is where Mamata Banerjee, and good for her, has kind of made a big move. She's trying to now create a coalition. She's trying to sideline the Congress because she's realized, she's seen blood in the water now. She's seen that over the last few years, this is the place in time where the BJP is at its weakest now, because it has rescinded something that it went all in on. And of course, the response, even in Modi sympathetic media, has been hilarious. From, you know, a tiger withdraws a few steps before making a chalan, to, you know, Modi has listened to the farmers. You know, as the bill was sold as something which is beneficial to the farmers, then why would you then listen to the farmers and not do something? There's no logic. And it's very simple why the BJP took a step back, because they were just losing too much political capital. It was not worth it for them anymore. But it's this kind of weakness that I believe really, really, really hurts a party like BJP, especially a party like BJP, whose projection is of strength, whose projection is of strong majoritarian strength, for them then to take something which is not minor, which is a major, which has been made a major part of their, let's say, overall, things that they have done over the last few years, to take something as major as this and to roll it back, it's a big loss of face. And again, in a democracy where you want to project a very strong leader, it's this loss of face which really, I think, brings about a loss in votes. This challenge to Narendra Modi is not just going to come from Mamata Banerjee, it's going to come from the other more extreme right elements of his party, like Yogi Adityanath, who is still seen to be somebody who's decisive and who, when he says something, does it. And if you recall, the waning of the influence of L.K. Advani was precisely because of this, that L.K. Advani, who was once seen to be a very decisive, aggressive, the tip of the spear for BJP, ultimately in the later half of his career, kind of went through a period where it wasn't sure what he was actually, what he actually stood for. If you go back to his famous Jinnah comment, now if you really read what he said, it wasn't very outrageous what he said. What he said was actually historically grounded in fact. But as the head of the BJP, you just can't say it. You just can't go ahead and make a subtle, nuanced historical point about Jinnah and Gandhi. I mean, if you want to do that, be a professor of history. But if you want to lead a political party and you want to become the prime minister and you want to take it to victory, you as a leader of the, you know, the right wing of India cannot be seen to be praising Jinnah over Mahatma Gandhi. Just cannot be. And again, this is where I think he lost the story. I think it really hurt him. And that's why he never became the prime minister and had to settle as Margdarshak Mandal. So this, I think this is a risk that, this is something which I'm not saying has happened to Modi right now, but is on the danger. There's a risk of that happening because Modi is kind of going to be seen as somebody who's not that decisive, who, you know, when he goes all in, he doesn't go all in. He can be brought back. And besides the fact that it kind of tells a lot of other people that all that we need to do is we need to have a very strong political opposition. We don't need to go through the courts. We don't need to go through parliament. We don't need to go through election. We just need to block the streets. Just like how long can we block the streets? So there's one more thing that comes back to what I'd said about farmers. Now, do you think that any other pressure group in India, let's say middle class, you know, you have taxation, every government loves to tax the middle class. And the reason why they can do it is because the middle class can't go and block the streets. First of all, the middle class is not organized. Nobody even defines what the middle class is. And the most important thing is, unlike the farmers, most middle class people cannot leave their jobs and sit on the streets for more than a year. And, you know, essentially there is no reason why they will have to go back, because ultimately the difference between farmers and middle class people is that we don't have that kind of passive income. We would all lose our jobs. So no matter what you feel about any issue, there is a limit to how long you're going to protest. And the government very well knows that. So the government knows they just need to outlast you. I mean, in terms of outlasting you, you know, the government is very good at that because, of course, it's the government. But in this case, with respect to farmers, what the government realized was that they couldn't outlast the farmers' agitation. This, I think, was what they had thought initially, that kya hoga? You know, ek mahine ke liye karega, do mahine ke liye karega, chhe mahine ke liye karega. But then they'll just go back. But no, they were not going back. They were not going back for very proper reasons, because for them, if they went back and took this would essentially end their hold on, you know, something that's fairly lucrative. So they had everything to lose by walking away from it. It's just that the government underestimated their resolve and underestimated their understanding of what they stood to lose, not just in terms of policy, but in terms of their hold over the politics in those states. So they had a lot to lose and they didn't walk away. And the government essentially blinked. And I think what ultimately, nobody in India will remember the farm bills. Most people possibly haven't read what the farm bills are. But ultimately, what they will remember is even Modi's supporters. I'm not saying that when I'm saying this, I'm not talking about the Congress supporters, AAP supporters. In any case, not going to vote for Modi. But what many of, I'm not talking about the diehard BJP supporters, but many people who are kind of on the middle, which is, I think, where elections are won. It's never won on the extremes. It's always like, who can move the middle? This is going to matter. The fact that they walked away is going to matter. It's going to matter on an emotional way. It's going to matter in their perception of Modi as being this Iron Man of India. And they are going to, on one hand, there is going to be Yogi Adityanath. He's definitely going to be, and I've said this many years ago, that, you know, what I see is that the relation between Modi and Advani is exactly what's going to happen between Modi and Yogi. So Modi will ultimately shift to being somewhat centrist and Yogi will take his place. And then ultimately there will be somebody else. And this is exactly what happens in politics. And so this is the first step, I believe, could be in Modi's path towards becoming the next Advani. I'm of course, this is a very extreme hypothesis that I'm saying. The BJP is still strong, but I think that this is the first major narrative blunder that the BJP has done on the farm bill. I'm not saying that they could have made it through. I think there were possibly good reasons for them doing it. But it's not going to serve them well in the narrative that they want to keep in order to project Modi as this kind of Iron Man, this very decisive leader in the face of people like Rahul Gandhi, who's kind of shown to be somebody who says one thing today, one thing another, does none of this make sense. This is where I think that they are going to suffer. Let's see how it pans out. But I felt, and there was just one final thing that I wanted to talk about, which was, this was perhaps a large scale, something which possibly the entire India saw, but those of us who follow Bengal politics have already seen it before. So for a, you know, right-wing cadre-based party like BJP, it's very important that they protect their flock. What happened in Bengal was, again, it's not something which Modi will suffer outside Bengal. Nobody knows this. Honestly, nobody cares. But the fact is that the BJP, in order to win elections, and I think this is a critique of the Amit Shah reign, is that they're just so focused on winning elections that they're absolutely willing to compromise on their principles. So what they did was they allied themselves with people in Bengal who had absolutely, who ranged from clowns to people who were just in the BJP because they had CBI cases against them. And the moment they went in, they did stuff which now, in retrospect, you wonder which side they were playing for even then. And then once the elections were over, they went back to Trinamool Congress once all the cases had been essentially been dropped. So the BJP were played. And while it's okay, fine, that's what politics is. It's about people playing other people. But the fact is that the BJP did not stand behind their cadre. They did not stand behind many people who came over to the BJP. And they just kind of left them to dry once the elections were done. So their top leadership, many of them went over to Trinamool Congress. The central leadership that was there, that was kind of acting as a representative of Amit Shah, they just left the state and never came back again. And this, you know, this again, for a cadre-based party that wants to project strength, this is a terrible thing to do. People will remember that. And politics, again, as I said, politics is not, you know, about principle. It's not about performance in that sense, in terms of metrics and data. Politics is about emotion. Politics is about what in the US say, somebody who you want to have a beer with. So it's about somebody who you believe represents your values, somebody who you believe represents what a leader should be. That's really who people vote for when it comes down to the chase. And I think the Bengal thing is a small thing in the context of India, but I think it showed something about, but the withdrawal of the farmer bills and, you know, the way that was done, perhaps is a harbinger of things to come. And this is I think the best time for the Indian opposition. And I'm glad Mamata Banerjee has taken advantage of that. I'm glad because I've always felt that the real opposition for the BJP isn't Congress, it isn't Rahul Gandhi. And it's time that people realize that. So if you're somebody who doesn't like the government, it's time that you stop betting on Rahul Gandhi. You know, it's not, you know, no matter what the different magazines say, that Rahul Gandhi has arrived. They've been running that headlines from 2005. It's not going to happen. He's not going to arrive. Rinku Singh is not going to become the next Sachin Tendulkar. So it's not going to happen. So it's about time that, you know, people started looking at regional leaders with ambition. And Mamata Banerjee has a very strong portfolio in Bengal. She can hold her state, and she's proven that. Even under the onslaught of the full might of the BJP, she held her state. So that is table stakes. And so I think that it's great for her politically that she's kind of using this time to stretch out and to, make allies and to make a play for the throne of Delhi. I think it's good. I think this is the time for her because this is the time that I think the BJP is at its weakest. Thanks a lot for listening to the podcast. That's about it. I will hopefully be back sooner than this time. And bye-bye, everybody. Have a nice day. Bye.